I call the Subcommittee for Mining, Forestry, and Tourism to order. Today's date is February 8th, and Representative Lehman moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. All right, we're going to be going through and kind of get the state of mining in committee today. We appreciate the opportunity to gather together this morning. We have Director Richards first on the list. We appreciate you coming in this morning, and we look forward to hearing from you. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Jess Richards, Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to come in today. We have a lot of Iron Rangers in the crowd, so if I make any mistakes on my history presentation, I'm sure they will point it out to me. Mr. Chair, we're going to go through just a brief history today of how iron ore was discovered and the iron mining on the Iron Range, talk a little bit about the current facilities up there on the range, and then also a few slides just giving you an overview of what the DNR does with respect to mining. Before we get going, Mr. Chair, I've got a chunk of iron ore from hitting taconite, and it's section 36, so school trust ore, little magnet to pass around. You can see where the iron bands are, and so we'll get that going as I talk, just for a little visual. Okay, so let's get started with a little Minnesota history. If you take a look at the map, If you take a look at the map on the screen, you can see that Minnesota has three key iron formations: the Vermilion Range, the Mesabi Range, and the Cuyuna Range. And in the mid 1800s, explorers were drawn to Minnesota primarily looking for the potential for gold. And one of those prospectors was George Stuntz, and he's showing a drawing of him is shown on the right side of this slide. And he was looking for gold, had rumors of gold around Lake Vermilion. And in 1865, he was out looking for gold near Lake Vermilion, and instead, he discovered iron ore in the area that's now Sudan and is now known as the Vermilion Range. So you can see that on the far north end of the map, the Vermilion Range, and that's where Mr. Stuntz found iron ore. Now, as with most history, there is some controversy as to whether Mr. Stuntz was actually the first one to find iron ore, but he was definitely the first one to make a big deal about it. Going farther then, in 1890, the Merritt family discovered Minnesota's most renowned iron ore resource, the Mesabi Range. Again, this is debatable as to who actually found the Mesabi Range, but the Merritt family was key, and they opened the Mountain Iron Company. So the Mesabi Range, you can see here, stretches 110 miles from Grand Rapids to Babbitt, and it's been mined for over 130 years. Although there's some disagreement among scientists, the prevailing theory is that the Mesabi Range was created when iron and silica eroded into a big ancient sea, and then with the presence of marine algae, it allowed that iron to precipitate out in that sea and deposit what's known as the Mesabi Range. And finally, if you look to north-central Minnesota, you can see the discovery of the Cuyuna Range, which was the nation's largest source of manganese. And in 1895, a gentleman named Kyler Adams was out doing survey work, investigating lands for a summer home, and his compass started to act strangely, and he ended up discovering what's known as the Cuyuna Range. Now, Mr. Adams then decided to acquire a bunch of land in the area and created multiple companies, and he named the Cuyuna Range after himself and his dog, Una. So that discovery of iron ore was quickly followed by Minnesota's first mining operations. And the first half century of Minnesota mining was primarily what we would call natural ore. And this was rock that had a real high concentration of iron ore, 65% or greater, and it could be fed directly into the steel mills. And in 1884, Minnesota sent its first shipment of iron ore out of the Sudan mine, which is shown here. This mine is now part of the Lake Vermilion Sudan Mine Underground Mine State Park. Near Tower in Sudan. The mine elevator is still in operation, and we have over 32,000 visitors a year to that state park, and I encourage you to go to it if you haven't been. It's a great tour. We get about 5,000 youth groups through there every year, too. In 1892, then, the Merritts opened the Mountain Iron Company in Mountain Iron, Minnesota, and they began mining on the Mesabi Range. And we'll come back to the Mesabi Range in a little bit. But at the time, in publications, the Mesabi Range was hailed as the greatest iron ore district the world's ever known. The first shipment of manganese from the Cuyuna Range came in 1911. And along with the other ranges, Minnesota became just a critical source of raw materials to build the infrastructure of the nation. And it was also critical in the success in both world wars. By the end of World War II, most of the natural ore, the high-quality natural ore, was gone. And Minnesota's mining communities and industry faced kind of an uncertain future. But true to form, Minnesotans rose to the challenge, and University of Minnesota professor Edward Davis had been spending decades researching a new process to process and ship Minnesota's lower-grade ore. And by the 1950s, he was piloting a new process to convert low-grade ore, 20% iron or so, into what we now know as taconite pellets. And Kelsey Johnson's going to be talking more about taconite later, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it's safe to say that the invention of the taconite pellet saved Minnesota's mining industry and secured the next generation of mining in Minnesota, particularly on the Mesabi Range. So by the 1980s, there was active taconite mines all across the Mesabi Range. Just summing up the history a little bit, it was a quick history, but going all the way back to the first shipment of ore in 1884 and until today, Minnesota's produced over 4.7 billion tons of iron ore, and most of that has come from the Mesabi Range. Today, the U.S. Utilizes around 50 million tons a year of ore, and Minnesota has the capacity to produce 40 million of those tons. Iron ore has been mined in Minnesota for over 130 years, and by some estimates, we have well over 100 years of resource still available in the ground. Okay, now getting up to a modern day real quickly, let's start taking a look at our mining industry that we have today. If you can't read the slide on the screen, you've got a printout in front of you of a map. You still might need your cheaters to look at it, but this will take you through the Mesabi Range. And what I'd like to do is start in the west and work our way east and describe to you the different companies that are working and doing iron ore mining on the Mesabi Range. First, you can see down on the far left side is ERPI plants 4 and 2 near Beauvais. So ERP Iron Ore Inc. recently acquired what was the Magnetation assets out of bankruptcy. This just happened in the last couple weeks. These are scram mining operations. It means that they reprocess old waste rock and tailings into iron ore concentrate. Some of these plants started in 2009, with the most recent being Plant 4, which you can see on the map, that just started a few years ago. Next, you see the location of the Mesabi Metallic site, which is previously known as the Esser Steel site. This project has had a number of starts and stops and is currently in bankruptcy proceedings. Next, you move up and you see the ERP plant number 1. This was the first scram mining operation. And just north of that is U.S. Steel's Keewatin Taconite Mine, which has been in operation since 1969. And it's just getting going again here, which is great. Moving up the range, you can see Hibbing Taconite. This mine is operated by Cliffs Natural Resources and is a joint venture between ArcelorMittal, Cliffs, and U.S. Steel. Hibbing Taconite's been in operation since 1976. And they even once had to move the city of Hibbing to accommodate mining in this area. Pretty neat area to go look at the Hull Rust Overlook. You can see where some of the old city streets are in Hibbing. It's kind of neat. Next, you see Mining Resources, which is just south of Chisholm. And this is owned by Steel Dynamics out of Indiana. This site is also still idle. And just north of the city of Mountain Iron is U.S. Steel's Mintac Taconite Mine. And this is the largest iron ore mine in the United States, and the single largest miner of school trust ore in Minnesota. It's been in operation since 1967. And when operating at full capacity, this mine, along with Keetac, produced almost half of the pellets that were produced on the Iron Range. So as the iron formation turns back to the south, we enter an area that's known as the Virginia Horn. And first we see ArcelorMittal Minorca Taconite Mine. The Minorca operations stretch across the horn toward Gilbert and Bowabic, and ArcelorMittal is the largest steelmaking company in the world, and this mine is a critical source of raw materials. At the base of the horn near Eveleth, you find United Taconite, and Actually, the first picture on my first slide was a view from United Taconite, looking up at the city of towards the city of Virginia. United Taconite's oil reserves stretch under Highway 53, and you may have heard of that, and they'll be mining that in that direction. UTAC began operation in 1965, and you can see then that UTAC ships its ore by rail slightly to the south for processing of pellets. And this is also the site where Cliffs will be introducing a new specialized pellet, the Mustang pellet, and they're doing a nice project down there for that. We jump now to the area of Hoyt Lakes in Aurora, and we find the former LTV mine site, which is now owned by Cliffs Erie. Within this site, we have the Mesabi Nugget Plant. It's a first-of-its-kind plant that produces a nugget that's 97% iron. It can be used in electric arc furnaces. And Nugget, as we call it, is run by Steel Dynamics and was opened in 2010. It's currently idle, but they're keeping it in good maintenance, hopefully to get it going again. And then last but not least, on the far east end of the Mesabi Range is the North Shore Mine near Babbitt. And North Shore mines and crushes on site and then ships its crushed ore 47 miles to Silver Bay for processing into pellets. North Shore is the site of the first taconite mine in North America, and they began mining there in 1955. So I just want to quickly highlight just a few of the benefits to Minnesota from iron ore mining. Multiple benefits, and it's been that way for decades. In 2014, iron ore mineral royalties set a new record at over $70 million, which is distributed to schools, the university system, and local taxing districts. And beyond mineral royalties in 2014, the industry generated almost $130 million in state and local taxes. According to a UMD study, when fully operational, the iron ore mining industry is responsible for 11,000 direct and indirect jobs in Minnesota. So clearly, those are just a few of the benefits. I mean, we could go on with multiple different benefits, but those are some big key ones there. And just to articulate a little bit more just on the royalty front, taking a closer look at that, as I mentioned, we hit a record in 2014 of $70 million. In that same year, $51 million was generated for the school trust fund. And over 90% of that revenue, of that school trust fund revenue, came from the U.S. Steel Mintec mine. Due to the downturn in the industry recently, in the past 2 years, you can see that there's a decline in royalties for 2015 and 2016, although they didn't get as low as the 2010 downturn, so that's good. The school trust revenues, royalty revenues go to the trust, and they benefit, as you've heard before, every school district in the state of Minnesota. Commissioner Tom Rukavina last week talked about the University Trust and how it's generated numerous scholarships for Minnesota students. And then the tax forfeit minerals go directly to benefit local schools, county governments, and communities where the mining is actually taking place. Okay, Mr. Chair, I've just got a few more slides just to quickly go over what DNR's role is with respect to mining. We have the Lands and Minerals Division, and we also have the Ecological and Water Resources Division that both play a role in mining. You're familiar with the three elements of the DNR's mission, the three core elements, and DNR's work touches all parts of this mission on mining. But specific to mineral development, we also have Minnesota Statute 93001. I think it's important for everybody to understand what this statute says, and it says it's the policy of the state to provide for the diversification of the state's mineral economy through long-term support of mineral exploration, evaluation, environmental research, development, production, and commercialization. So you can see by looking just at our mission and one of the statutes that we are obligated to follow, that DNR has a really unique role in mining and minerals, and it's important that we're able to balance all those roles. So taking a quick look, the Lands and Minerals Division plays a key role in the area of mineral development. Under state statute, we have a duty to manage state-owned minerals for the benefit of the school trust fund, university fund, and local taxing districts. We have a group of staff that are completely separate from our regulatory staff that work and focus on this type of development work. You can see here a picture of our drill core library. If you haven't been there, we'd love to host a tour for that as well. We have about 3 million feet of drill core for mineral exploration across the state of Minnesota. This site is used by exploration companies, university researchers, students to take a look at what's available in Minnesota to try to hone in on areas they might be interested in. The Drill Corps Library is the best Drill Corps Library in the nation, and it's really a selling point for Minnesota to attract interest.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Just kind of a question on that Drill Corps Library. Have they put an estimate of value as far as, you know, kind of that spectrum, just sort of what that value have, what's left in the ground currently?
Mr. Chair, I believe Pete Clevenstein in my hitting office knows that, but I don't know it on the top of my head, okay. So I'd be happy to find that
out. Sounds great. Thank you.
The Drill Corps Library has drill core that was drilled back all the way back in 1905, and that's some iron ore core. And then also our oldest rock in the Drill Corps Library is 2.6 billion years old. So we also have a number of geologists that specialize in screening state lands for mineral potential, and they are experts that work in the field. They get out and they look for opportunities for gold, dimension stone, and other things. And then last week we announced our next mineral lease sale. We lease state lands for mineral exploration and mining. And then, as all of the mining GMs and folks that are here today know, we are meticulous about collecting our royalties revenues, and we do a good job of staying out the mines and monitoring the development of state ore to make sure the state is able to receive all the royalties that is due for that mining. And then finally, I just want to mention on the development end, DNR also serves as the chair of the state's Minerals Coordination Committee. And this committee is laid out also in state statute and is responsible for focusing on the diversification of Minnesota's mineral economy. Our next role with respect to mining and minerals is regulatory. And we have a number of different regulatory roles. We inspect the exploration process to make sure it's being done correctly and protecting natural resources. You can see some shots here of mineral exploration going on, during and after the exploration is done. The DNR's Division of Ecological and Water Resources leads any environmental review, so environmental assessment worksheets or environmental impact statements related to mining, and the Lands and Minerals Division provides technical support and expertise to those reviews. Both the Ecological and Water Resource Divisions and the Lands and Minerals Division handle permitting of mining operations. Lands and Minerals handles the permit to mine, which is kind of an all-encompassing permit, including things like financial assurance. And Lands and Minerals also handles wetland permits and water appropriation permits for mines. And the Ecological and Water Resources Division handles tailings dam safety permits, as well as endangered species taking permits. And we coordinate closely between the two divisions. I have Joe Henderson here with me today from our office, and part of his job is just to make sure we are coordinated with other divisions and other agencies with respect to mining permits. And then also, both on a regulatory front, both divisions inspect mines on a regular basis to ensure compliance with the permits. And our last role with respect to minerals and mining is reclamation. And our reclamation work goes hand in hand with our regulatory work. We spend a lot of time monitoring reclamation of impacted mine lands and also work with the mines and local communities to develop reclamation plans that facilitate future use. We have a great example with United Taconite, where the city, the company, and the DNR worked together to come up with some innovative management of a stockpile that was very visible to the community. And in that collaboration, it worked out to have a really nice reclamation plan for that stockpile. We also do environmental research with respect to mining, and that research is focused on trying to find solutions to complex issues and to inform permitting decisions. The Lands and Minerals Office in Hibbing houses research facilities that help us monitor and understand everything from leachate that might be generated from waste rock to the performance of engineered wetlands on tailings basins in a reclamation setting. And some of this research work has been going on for over 30 years. We have field-scale studies at the site. You can see a picture of one of the field-scale studies here on the bottom. And then also we conduct sampling and studies at the mines themselves in cooperation with the mining companies. Another thing on the picture here is just an example of a reclaimed mine slope on the top, and after a number of years, what it looks like after the growing seasons are there. We're going to be publishing some of our research soon on our website, so look for that. So, Mr. Chair, I hope the brief presentation with this, you can see that Minnesota has a rich iron mining history over 130 years, and it's survived through innovation and the creation of taconite. It benefits our schools, our local communities, in our state. And DNR is proud to serve in this role for Minnesotans for mineral development and regulation of the mine sites, and we look to provide balance and professionalism and ensure sound development of our state's natural resources.
Thank you, Director.
With that, I'll take any questions.
Yes, thank you, Director Richards. We have Representative Metza.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and not really a question, just more of a statement. I'd like to thank you for your continued cooperation in the region. I think Lands and Minerals has done an outstanding job in general, making sure that the permits we need are there, the questions are getting asked, and in particular, on my first term in office, we had a bill and we're looking for ways to have the MPCA and DNR working together and got some of those hires, and it has seemed to be productive for everyone. So I just appreciate those continued efforts moving forward and in the past, and apologize to the committee for being late here. We were at Mary Murphy's memoriam, so to speak, for Dave Battaglia, who recently passed away, so our apologies for being late.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Richards. Could you just talk real briefly about kind of a newcomer to the mining agenda, and that's obviously the non-ferrous copper-nickel stuff, and the other one that's been with us for quite a while that a lot of people may not be intimately familiar with is the peat mining. That obviously there's stuff going on in both of those areas within the state of Minnesota, and I know you folks are intimately involved in that.
Mr. Dale, can we just hold that one off? We're going to kind of stick to the iron side today, and I think we'll have another opportunity to take a crack at that question.
I think that'd be great. We could have a whole nother session on copper nickel.
All right. Anything else? And you'll be here for the rest of the, if you feel, whatever. All right. President Johnson, we look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for coming before us today. So,
thank you.
If you'd like to state your name and who you're with for the record.
Okay. Kelsey Johnson, I'm president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, and I'm just going to do a little presentation for you guys about kind of the how iron is made. We did give you taconite pellet kits, too. If you go from one side to the other, what you'll see is that there's raw material, and then we take that rock and we crush it up into a very fine talcum powder, and that's iron ore concentrate, and then we mix it with a couple other things, and I'm going to let the general managers talk a little bit more about that process, but and then we bake it at about 2,400 degrees in the furnace, and that's how we get our pellets. But I'm going to kind of let this video play. Let's see if the audio is hooked up.
Most of us don't think much about the things we use in our everyday lives, how they're made or where they come from. But we all use products made out of steel every day. Cars, trucks, bridges, buildings, roads, farm equipment, appliances, and more. In fact, our quality of life could not exist without steel and these products. High-quality steel can't be made without iron ore. The American iron mining and steel making process all starts here. On Minnesota's Iron Range, the unique geology of the land exposes iron-bearing materials. It's commonly referred to as the Mesabi Formation. This iron formation was deposited about 1.8 billion years ago, long before dinosaurs even roamed the earth. Before a mine can be opened, an extensive environmental review process must be followed. An Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, and mining permits must be obtained from the government. The Environmental Impact Statement is an in-depth environmental review and study of how the mine's activities and processing plant would impact the environment, human health, and the economy in Minnesota. The EIS and permitting process includes not only scientific studies, economic impact studies, and sampling of the environment around the proposed mine, but also public meetings so people can share in the review process. permits to mine take into account all the information developed in the EIS and define requirements the mining facility must operate under in order to comply. The permit to mine also includes the mining company's agreements on how the disturbed areas will be returned to a natural state once the end of the mine life is reached. This phase of the environmental process is known as mine land reclamation and is often done during the active life of the operation or shortly after the end of the operation. Reclamation consists of modifying the disturbed land and returning it to a more natural state of hills, grassland, forests, and lakes for the benefit of future generations. The pits left behind from iron mining will become lakes where fish are stocked, and depending on future land use needs, shorelines could include residential developments, cabins, resorts, or public lands. Once all the permits, restoration plans, and financial assurances are in place, mining can begin. As one can imagine, the permitting process takes several years. Taconite is the term used to describe the iron-bearing rock found in a portion of the Mesabi Iron Formation. It's an extremely hard rock and contains around 40% iron. Using explosives, the iron ore is blasted into chunks small enough to handle in large excavators. The largest excavator on the iron range can hold up to 65 tons of rock. The machines place the taconite rock into giant haul trucks. These trucks are as big as a house and hold up to 240 tons of rock. The trucks take the iron ore directly to the processing plant and the unneeded overburden to the nearby stockpiles. At the processing plant, the ore is crushed into even smaller pieces by rock-crushing machines. The crushers keep crushing the rock until it's the size of a marble or smaller. The rock is then mixed with water and ground finer in rotating mills until it's as fine as powder. The iron-bearing mineral, called magnetite, is separated from the non-magnetic, non-iron-bearing waste rock using magnetism. The remaining rock is waste material, called tailings, and is stockpiled in large basins. The magnetite-bearing material has now been upgraded to higher iron content, now the size of fine sand, and is called concentrate. Some mines use a process called flotation to further separate the iron from unwanted materials such as silica by placing the concentrate in the slurry in large vats that froth or foam. The higher concentrate iron slurry is then separated by large vacuums which draw off the water, resulting in a drier cake-like substance with more iron and less water. The concentrate is rolled with clay inside large rotating cylinders. The cylinders cause the powder to form marble-sized balls. This is like rolling wet, sticky snow into balls to make a snowman. The balls are then heated until they're red hot. The balls become hardened and eventually cool. The finished product is an iron ore pellet containing 65% iron and designed to melt efficiently in a blast furnace. The iron pellets are transported by rail, most often to ore docks, where they're loaded into lakers along the shore of Lake Superior. These ore boats sail on the Great Lakes to Gary, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, or other steel-making towns in the Great Lakes region of the United States, where the steel mills melt down the pellets in blast furnaces to make the steel used to make the products that we use every single day.
It appears that my presentation did not make it, but you did receive a copy of the PowerPoint slides in your packet. So just to jump ahead, we're on the history of iron mining page. In 1930, we had the development of hot mill sheet steel, and in 1941, we created the taconite production tax. Between 1941 and 1945, we actually shipped 411 million tons of ore. That was what kind of depleted our raw iron product. And in 1956, we started to produce more and more taconite. So we opened two more taconite iron mining and processing facilities. In 1974, Minnesota, we had our production peak at about 65 million tons. And to give you an idea, right now as a nation, we produce roughly 65 million tons. Minnesota produces about 85% of that. And so we're still one of the leading, well, we are the leader when it comes to iron mining production. In 1987, flux pellets were introduced, and in 2010, we saw some high-grade iron nuggets commercially produced. We're still innovating, and we're finding new ways to use the products that we have on the Mesabi Iron Range. Just kind of went over the map of where all of our facilities are. We represent 11 iron mining facilities on the Iron Range, and there are about 8 that are operational right now. When we're at capacity, we have 4,200 miners that we employ, and roughly 13,000 in the vendor community. And we're very lucky to have about 175 vendor members as part of the Iron Mining Association. We ship our product, and our vendor members are a participant in that as well. So they help us with everything from the tires on the trucks to the conveyor belts and to shipping the overall product to market. This kind of gives you the overview of our association, the Iron Mining Association, and kind of who our members are and what they're up to. And we're lucky enough today to have quite a few of them here, so we're going to have them come down and testify and talk to you about their direct operations and what they're up to. To kind of give you an idea, you don't see it often, but steel is a major part of everything that you do every day. And our iron helps create a lot of that steel. Our iron is used from anything from the construction materials in this building to the refrigerator that you use, the car you drive, the bridges you drive on, the rail cars that you see passing you, the trucks, everything around you. And that all comes from Minnesota Iron. Then it kind of gives you a nice list of some of the things that you'll see, even cutlery and the kitchen sink. Minnesota Iron's economic impact is very vast. Roughly, according to a study, we contribute about $3 billion to the state's economy, and that was according to 2010 numbers, with roughly 11,200 jobs. We were 30% of the gross regional product in northeastern Minnesota, and that, compared to tourism and forestry, kind of pales in comparison. So we are a major contributor to the overall economy in northeastern Minnesota. Each iron ore mining job generates an additional 1.8 jobs in other industries, and that's because our miners are paid very well. They spend their dollars in the local grocery store. They go to the local clinics for their health care. They send their kids to the local schools for education. To kind of give you an idea, we did do a 2014 taxes and distribution, and there's further detail, too, in this brochure that you received in your packet. On the back page of this, it breaks down both our taxes and royalties amounts given, and it also breaks down the overall capacity of each of the facilities. So if you go to that, what you'll see is that in 2014, we paid over $188 million into both with our production and our occupation tax, but also with our royalties. And that was a peak at the time, but we hope to be back at that capacity at some point in the near future. As you can see from the breakdown, we give quite a bit of money to not only the cities and the local communities, but to the IRRB, to the county, to the school trust funds, to the University of Minnesota Trust, and to the general fund. And so we work closely with the state, and we continue that relationship in the hopes that we can continue a long and strong relationship into the future. Minnesota Iron actually has a national impact, too, and according to a recent U.S. Homeland Security estimate. Annually, we produce about 40 to 45 million tons of iron ore and 85% of the domestic iron ore production. But when it comes down to the nation's impact, our iron supports roughly $1.1 trillion in the national economy, and that's in if you bring us full circle into the steel world as well. So our iron contributes quite a bit to the overall national economy. It supports 10.9 million jobs in the nation. That's also with the steel making and all of the retail work as well. Each ton of iron ore contributes roughly $23,800 in economic value. And to kind of give you an idea, I know they showed in the video that we have Lakers that ship all of our products all over the Great Lakes, but there are 48 of them that carry our product to the mills all over the Great Lakes. And this is an old map of what the carrying capacity of the Lakers is. This is from the 1920s, but it's still relevant today. Many of these steel mills are still producing steel today. But you can see kind of the overall impact of what our product is and where it goes. But it starts with us, and it goes throughout the entire Great Lakes system. And then I also wanted to show you kind of our overall, when we're shipping our products. You'll see the Lakers moving in and out of the Great Lakes and through the Duluth Harbor quite a bit, but we drop off in February and March due to the icing. Usually there's icing on the lake, but some years there isn't, some years there is. It's very difficult to ship when you've got ice on the lake. And to kind of give you an idea of where we ship our product, it kind of breaks down. We ship our products to Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, the Detroit area, and then it kind of continues on from there. But we do contribute overall 2% to the overall global iron ore production. And I know that seems small, but we're very mighty. So I'd like to continue that legacy in the future. The last is just the references page for all of you.
Any questions? All right, the Representative Uglum.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, great presentation and everything. In the future, with the international markets and things in terms of steel, I understand that China is cutting back a little bit on their production because of some of their massive environmental problems and things. Do you foresee an upturn and a better future here in the near term because of international markets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, that's the hope. It is going to be, China's just one of the players in the global market and one of the threats that we'll see long term. We do have much higher standards here in Minnesota, and I think that's due in large part to our close collaboration with the communities and the relationship we have with the state. But I do think that the global competition is going to be a long-term issue for us into the future. And as we have seen in the past couple months, we've seen some positive signs in the industry, but I can't stress this enough. I mean, we're still down. We still have three facilities that are idled, and we're nowhere back at our maximum capacity or output. And so my hope is that we can, in collaboration with folks, you know, work together to try and bring that all back online and continue to be as competitive as possible.
Representative Uglum?
When you speak of competitiveness and everything else, a lot has been talked about the cost of production in Minnesota, the high energy costs and things. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum. The energy costs are a very big concern. In fact, the legislature passed in 2015 the Energy Intensive Trade Exposed Rate, and in collaboration with our electric partners, we were able to receive a reduction through the PUC. However, the PUC has yet to finalize that order. They did decide that having a reduction is of benefit to not only the industry but also to the state. We have seen our energy rates rise 60% in the last 8 years, and that's an extensive amount. And so when you have energy rates that are rising like that, it's untenable. It's very difficult to keep up and to be competitive. And so that's one of the concerns, but it is one of the major reasons with the reduction that we received from the Public Utilities Commission. It is one of the reasons that some of our facilities have come back online.
Thank you. All right. Representative Sundeed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of my questions is just asked and answered about the energy issue. That's a very, very critical issue as far as employment up in the Iron Range, the supply of energy coming out of the Cohasset facility. It's very important to the labor industry up there. Another question that I had, and I hope you have the answer, would be how much of the taconite goes through the Sioux locks on the St. Lawrence Seaway?
President Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundeen, all of our taconite goes through the Sioux locks, and the study that I was the study that I was quoting was the Polox study, not to be confused with the Polish folks. It's P-O-E. But that study did conclude that all of our iron goes through the Sioux locks, and we would like to continue to see a good relationship with the federal government on that side. They are looking at expanding that at some point in the future, and that's our hope, is that it'll open up opportunities to ship more product in a shorter time frame.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment on the Sioux locks. That's I think if those were to close down or be damaged or whatever, that would just bring this industry to a halt. And I'm just very concerned about the condition of the Sioux locks, and I think everybody in this room should be aware of how critical the maintenance of the Sioux locks is to this industry and all the shipping on the Iron Range. So we've got to partner with the federal government and encourage them to maintain the Sioux locks, because if they go down for any particular reason, this is bringing the taconite industry to a halt.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sundeen. All right. Thank you, President Johnson, for coming before us. With that, we have General Manager Mastantonio. How did I do with that?
Perfect.
All right. If you want to just introduce yourself for the record and who you're with, then we'd love to hear from you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hosting the hearing. My name is Chris Mastantonio. I work for United States Steel Corporation. I'm based in Pittsburgh at our headquarters. I'm responsible for our government affairs operations here in Minnesota, but also at all of our steelmaking locations, which will include Indiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Texas, Alabama, as well as a few joint ventures. I want to talk about our company. It's an honor for me to be here today representing U.S. Steel and the amazing men and women that work for our facilities here in Minnesota. I understand today it's about minus 10 degrees up in Minntac, and the men and women are working hard every day, 24/7, to get that product delivered to the steel mills. So we appreciate their hard work. The first slide on my PowerPoint that I'll try to follow, and a lot of the information I'm going to present I think has been touched on already by Kelsey and Jess, who did an excellent job. But the first slide is just a general overview of our location within the state. You can see we're up in northeastern Minnesota. We operate two facilities, Minntac and Keetac, that we'll refer to. The next slide is a photograph, aerial photo of our Minntac facility, which is the largest mining operation in the United States, and it takes a lot of special people to operate that facility on a daily basis. It takes a lot of attention and care to make sure it's operating properly and protecting the environment every day while we do so. The next page is our Keetac facility, which was also made reference to. Keetac was down for about a year and a half recently, due to the decline in the requirements for the domestic steel industry. It was just announced a few weeks ago that it was being brought back online, and we're hopeful that by March 1st, early March, we'll be producing pellets again at Keetac. Thank everyone for their support over the past year and patience especially the members from the range delegation, that allowed us to bring that facility back online. The two facilities, as you heard, are the largest producers of iron ore in the United States, Minntac being the largest single facility. While our company has been in Minnesota for roughly 100 years producing ore, really it was 1967 or 1969, just referenced, when pellet production began. That was the introduction of the technology that allowed those facilities to lead in the production of taconite pellets. You'll see on the chart that there are five lines operating at Minntac, one line operating at Keetac. Keetac's annual production about 6 million tons a year, Minntac about 16 million tons a year. Just to give you an idea of the size of these facilities, Keetac's about 4.5 miles long, about a mile wide, and the ore body is about 300 feet deep. Minntac, about 9 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, and about 200 feet deep. So very large facilities, very capital intensive, very labor intensive to operate these facilities. I think you already had a good overview of the production process, which is my next slide. Generally, we mine the property, remove the waste, drill blast, remove the hard rock, take it to the crusher, which you saw a good picture of on Kelsey's video. We reduce the size of the rock from anywhere starting at 5 to 8 feet down to 8 inches or even a half inch at the Minntac facility. From the crusher, it goes to the concentrator, where it's further processed. The iron is separated magnetically, and then it's transferred for further processing to another plant we call the agglomerator, where it's processed into the pellets, which are the final product from the mines. Those pellets are shipped to the various steel mills that we operate here in the United States and a few other locations, and those steel mills turn it into the final product, which, as you heard, goes into cars, trucks, steel pipe for our company, building materials, and other steel products. So it all starts here in Minnesota for our company and for our steel mills. I want to talk a little bit about the importance of mining iron ore here in Minnesota. Some of this, again, was touched on. As you heard, our company is the largest producer of iron ore pellets, about 22 million tons annually when we're producing. That's roughly maybe a little under half of the domestic production of iron ore in the United States. There was reference to the U.S. Department of Interior U.S. Geological Survey that was released just about 2 weeks ago. In that survey, they stated that Minnesota is the fifth largest producer of iron ore, sand and gravel as well. Totals about $3.2 $7 billion in value added to the American supply chain for mining and steel production. During 2015 and 2016, we saw a difficult time for the American steel industry. There was an 11% decline in iron ore production, and that correlates to a lot of the other benefits from producing steel, including taxes, payroll, and what have you, which I'll get to in a minute. The U.S. produced about 40.8 million tons of iron ore in 2016, all of it from Minnesota and some from Michigan. That was down from about 46 million in 2015 and 56 million in 2014. Given those significant numbers, though, it's only 2% of the total ore production in the world. So you think about that number, 2%. That's a pretty fragile number. When you see some other foreign producers of ore ramping up production, it wouldn't take all that much for them to generate 2% more in their product line. So we need to maintain our competitive advantage here in Minnesota. We have to be able to compete globally on price and delivery and quality. And a lot of the reasons that you see us here at the Capitol talking to you all about issues, whether it's regulatory or energy or trade, it's really all focused on the same objective, to keep us competitive in a global market, which is very competitive. Because, again, we're only 2% of the ore produced. We want to maintain that 2%, hopefully grow that 2% someday. Here in Minnesota, the economic impact, I think, is pretty significant. At least we feel so at U.S. Steel. In addition to our taxes paid, payroll, and what have you, we also employ about 370 small businesses Those are our suppliers and vendors. The average payroll for our suppliers and vendors is about $600 million annually. Most of those companies are based in Minnesota. Every mining job that we employ creates another 1.8 jobs, according to the American Iron and Steel Institute. And as far as the production taxes that you heard about earlier, for the last 3 years, we've paid $43.8 million, $46.7 million, and $48 million, respectively, 2013, 14, 15. And most of that money stays on the Iron Range. A lot of it goes to the IRRRB and the communities and the schools. So we're proud that we're able to do that. We think it's important to the communities, and those numbers correlate directly with the production of those facilities. So it's important to keep those facilities producing, keep them competitive. I think Jess Richards referred to the school trust fund. U.S. Steel is the largest contributor. I think Jess mentioned 95%. I think it's probably close to 95%. I have 90% on the slide. You'll recognize some of the folks on the slide. Number nine, we had hosted a visit as part of the tour by the DNR and legislators of the school trust lands. This was about 2 years ago, I think. We welcome visitors. You are all welcome to visit with us. We welcome hosting the committee at some point when the weather gets a little better. We have a gentleman who runs those facilities named Larry Sutherland. You can see him in the photo in the white hat. Larry's a native of the Iron Range, has worked in mining for about 30 years. Started as a millwright, as a member of the USW, worked his way up through the ranks. Now he's running the facilities. Larry's heart is in his job, to say the least. He takes it very serious, and he would love to host this committee at some point. So consider that an invitation. The next slide gives you a little more detail on the royalty payments for the school trust fund. You can see how the bar graph correlates with production levels. I mentioned 2015, 2016, tough years for the steel industry, a decline in demand of steel, therefore a decline in demand of pellets. You can see what that meant for contributions to the school trust fund. We need to get those facilities running. Keytech, again, should be back up early March, and hopefully we'll see increases to the school trust fund as well. I just want to touch briefly on some of the challenges that we see operating the facilities as it relates to state government. Given the nature of the operation, we spent a lot of time working with the environmental agencies, MPCA in particular, DNR as well. There's always a challenge on permitting for whether it's expansion or any changes in the operations. It seems to take a little longer than it should. We would just ask for the agencies, the MPCA in particular, to have a more cooperative approach with us, to work with us, be partners, help us find solutions to problems. It shouldn't be an adversarial process. It should be one of state government working with the mining industry together to find solutions and move forward in a timely manner. There's also some uncertainty on some of the regulations. There seems to be changes in some of the rules and some of the requirements. It's kind of like a moving target in some cases. So we try to plan the business in a way so we know what's going to be required of the business, what the compliance standards are going to be. You prepare, you invest, try to meet those standards, and they seem to change. And I'm not saying it's the state's fault. The U.S. EPA is involved in this process as well. But that's a challenge for us. It's difficult to plan when the requirements tend to change. Interagency cooperation, that's important as well. We do have a good relationship, I think I can say, with the state legislature and the administration. I mean, we do work with them on a regular basis. And it's just, you know, sometimes it seems like it's a little bit of a struggle on some of these environmental issues. We wish that wasn't the case. Energy was mentioned earlier by Kelsey. It is critical. It's one of the biggest cost drivers, one of the biggest inputs into iron ore mining. We support a long-term policy that allows us to be competitive. In 2015, the House and Senate passed a bill that allowed our energy supplier, Minnesota Power, to establish something called an energy intensive trade exposed rate class, which was kind of unique for the large industrial energy consumers that are impacted by illegal trade. The language passed, the governor signed the bill, we had two lengthy hearings in front of the PUC. Finally, that rate class was approved, and we're hoping that later this year there'll be some finality to the new rate that is going to be established by Minnesota Power. So we appreciate all your support on that legislative victory. One item I do have to mention, going back to the environmental topic, you may have heard about this. Certainly, the members of the Range delegation are well aware of it. It's the state's wild rice sulfate water standard. I won't get into too much detail, but we've been working on this now, it seems like forever, 5 or 6 years. Minnesota has one of the most stringent standards. It is the most stringent sulfate water quality standard in the country, 10 milligrams per liter. It's based on outdated science, in our opinion. The standard needs to be reconsidered, reviewed, and revised. If not, it's going to be cost prohibitive, not just for the mining industry, but also your municipalities. Very expensive standard, not sure if there's any benefit to it, and really needs to be thought through, looked at, and revised. Otherwise, it's going to be harmful to Minnesota. On environmental, I do want to say we take it very seriously. We spend significant capital on protecting the environment by choice. It's not all forced upon us. This graph number 14 shows you our spending over the last 10 years, almost $150 million. This is no individual certain project. This is annual spending for environmental remediation, reclamation improvements that we do on a regular basis. I know many of you have been up to the operations. You can see them firsthand. Given the nature of what we do, blowing up mountains, forgetting equipment, moving the rocks, it's a really beautiful place, in my opinion. The surrounding areas are pristine. The water quality is excellent. And the operations are well run. The men and women who work there take their jobs very seriously. They live in these communities. They hunt, they fish, a lot of other outdoor activities. They're dedicated to the environment. The company's dedicated to the environment. We're going to invest the funds necessary to protect the environment. We just need a partner in the state to work with us to allow us to be competitive. Another item we're very proud of is the Iron Ore Alliance. This is a partnership between U.S. Steel and the United Steelworkers of America. I'm privileged to co-chair the Iron Ore Alliance along with John Rebrovich, who's the Assistant Director for the Steelworkers. In Minnesota, we work together on a number of issues that are of mutual importance to us, whether it's enforcing our trade laws in the United States, protecting the environment, workforce development, to name a few. We work together. We meet regularly. We meet up on the Iron Range. We present to community groups. We were just with the Laurentian Vision Partnership not too long ago. Made a presentation on sulfate as well recently. You can see in a photo we had a rally up on the range a couple of years ago on one of the trade issues. Senator Bach was kind enough, along with a number of other elected officials, to speak at that rally. So we have a very good relationship with the USW. The Iron Ore Alliance was founded because we recognized that, you know, the union and the company not getting along was not a good approach. We're in this together. We have a lot at stake, and we're going to work together to make sure these facilities are competitive so we can protect the jobs and the communities up on the Iron Range. The future, there was a question right before my presentation about what the future looks like. It's hard to say. It's hard to predict. The global markets are very challenging, whether it's steel or iron ore. We're optimistic, though, that we're going to continue to mine, invest, and employ in Minnesota. Certainly, the iron ore products are going to continue to be vital here in the United States. It's an important part of our everyday life. We're going to continue to work with this committee, other state and federal agencies, to try to get the results that can help us be competitive. We're going to continue to support common sense, science-based regulations, and we're going to do what we have to protect the environment. That's all I have. I appreciate, again, the time. It's a pleasure and honor to be here before you today. Thank you.
All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Eklund, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, the chairman, did much better with your name than I do. So, but anyway, back on the sulfate standard,
mm-hmm.
I've actually got two questions. But back on the sulfate standard, can you comment? You said $120 million in capital costs and tens of millions in operating costs. Do you have a comment on what the same impact will have on municipal treatment plants and that sort of thing? Because I think that's critical to a lot of our small towns, too.
General Manager at Mastantonio.
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 You got to get the
match. Hard to say, Representative. As you well know, the municipalities have become very engaged in this discussion. I know the cost is becoming the key issue for them. They have to either build new water treatment facilities or upgrade existing water treatment facilities. I don't want to speak on their behalf, and each municipality has a different situation, but I heard one large municipality recently could be paying up to almost $500 million. I think that's accurate. I'm looking at Peter Larson, who's really an expert on this topic. Others maybe a few million. I mean, it runs the spectrum, but it's a very expensive standard. And there was a recent meeting up on Mountain Iron with the MPCA on this topic, as you're aware. And I know one of the members of the USW asked a question to the MPCA staff. If the municipalities and the mining industry invest millions of dollars in technology required to meet the standard, will there be any improvement to the environment? And the representative said they don't know.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative?
One other thing, Mr. Chair, thank you. And first off, I'd like to thank you for your relationship with the steelworkers. Being a steelworker myself, as you know, I appreciate that, and it's a good to have the alliance where you can work on like issues. The other question I had is the SULOX that I mentioned earlier. What's the percentage of production that goes through there compared to other products that go through the SULOX? Do you have an idea on that?
Mr. Mastantonio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Beckman, I don't know the exact number, but I do know, I think it's the majority of the ore product that goes down to the steel mills is going through the SULOX. Ironically, I was just on the phone late last night with some of our company executives in Pittsburgh, and I know the Army Corps is looking to rebuild the locks, and the question becomes, will that result in a closing of the locks? And a closing of the locks is really just not an option. I mean, it would shut down the industry, as was mentioned earlier. So I know Governor Snyder and the Michigan legislature has called upon the new administration in Washington to make this one of their infrastructure priorities. So hopefully that request will resonate, and we won't have to have any disruption in shipping through the SULOX.
Representative Ackland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just one other question. Just on a back slide, you talked about the percentages, 2% of kind of production globally. What percentages of our 2% is consumed domestically? And then a two-part question, the second half, obviously recycling is a big percentage of kind of production, reusing. What percentage does that take up as far as, you know, reintroduction into the market?
Yep. Part of your answer, I'll probably defer to my colleagues at Cliff. They could probably answer it better. I can tell you, Mr. Chairman, that for United States Steel, if we're producing 22 million tons annually, the vast majority of it is being shipped to our steel mills in the United States. There may be some third-party contracts outside of our own domestic consumption. But our company, we're referred to as an integrated steel producer, which means we are totally integrated. We produce our mine, we make our coke from our coal, we put it in blast furnaces, and we make new steel products out of it. The recycling really occurs for companies that are sometimes called mini mill producers or electric furnace producers. They're melting scrap products. We do not have any electric furnace operations. We're 100% blast furnace. We do introduce some scrap into that process, the steelmaking process, but it's primarily it's new steel being made, starting out as iron in the blast furnace, going into the basic oxygen process, steelmaking process,
coming out as steel. So our pellets are being consumed domestically, primarily at our steel mills. The largest is in Gary, Indiana, but also in near Detroit, Michigan, near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Granite City, Illinois, places like that.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you very much. All right, Representative Sundin.
One more thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I should have asked this earlier, maybe you don't know the question, but reclamation of these mine sites is kind of an important topic for me. I've gone down to the Cuyuna Range and fished in those mines. I've been over to the Ladysmith mine, it's a precious metal mine that's been closed down, and restored to its natural settings. They've done a terrific job over there. But we heard earlier that there's a possibility of developing some of those old mine pits, you know, for residential uses. Has that actually occurred? Yeah. Do you know?
Mr. Mastantonio.
Yes, I will have to get back to you on that question. I am not aware of our company being engaged in the development of those sites right now, and Jess Richards may have a better answer for that. But the reclamation at our operating locations is just an ongoing process. I mean, constantly every day. So, sorry, I can't give you a better answer.
No, that's okay. I didn't really didn't expect it. I'll catch Kelsey Johnson offline, maybe.
Sounds good. Thank you. All right. Anything else? All right. Yes, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I might have a partial answer to the question about residential development. You might want to talk to some of the IRRB agency people who are here. That's sort of the goal of the Laurentian Vision Partnership is to work with the mining companies before they dig, to dig in such a way that the land can be actually used for development following mining. And that was kind of the vision for the Laurentian Vision Partnership that's run by the agency.
All right. Thank you. All right. With that, we're going to invite the Cliffs folks to come on down.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to introduce yourself and who you're with for the record, both of you.
Good morning, Chairman Studzinski, Vice Chairman Lewick, Ranking Member Metza, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Patrick Bloom. I serve as the Director of Government Relations for Cliffs Natural Resources. I'm pleased to be joined this morning by my colleague, Jack Croswell, who serves as the General Manager at Hibbing Taconite, which is the second largest taconite operation on Minnesota's Iron Range. HibTac, as mentioned earlier, is a joint venture between ArcelorMittal USA, Cliffs Natural Resources, and U.S. Steel, the three largest producers in northeast Minnesota. Cliffs manages that facility on behalf of the partnership. Jack has served at Hibbing Taconite for 37 years in various management roles. I will now turn it over to Jack to provide a brief overview of Cliffs Minnesota operations, and then I will subsequently speak to Cliffs strategic growth objectives.
Thank you, Chair. By way of background, Cliffs Natural Resources was founded in 1847 and is recognized as the largest and oldest independent iron ore mining company in the United States. In addition to Hibbing Taconite, Cliffs manages and wholly owns two other taconite facilities in Minnesota, United Taconite and North Shore Mining Company. Cliffs also operates the Tilden Iron Ore Mine in Michigan and a large iron ore mining complex in Western Australia. The three Minnesota mines operated by Cliffs employ over 1,700 individuals with a payroll of $205 million. You may have heard taconite mining jobs characterized as high quality or family sustaining jobs. To put that figure to characterization, the United Steelworkers employed at our facilities earn on average $105,000 in wages and benefits annually. Cliffs' three Minnesota operations contribute approximately $55 million in state and local taxes annually. They have a total economic impact of $840 million. This year, Cliffs celebrates 170 years. We are proud of our long history, the company's ability to withstand economic cycles, and the ability to adapt to the ever-changing iron and steel markets. Our presence in Minnesota dates back to 1902. And in recent years, we have continued to strengthen our commitment to Minnesota's Iron Range. Let me provide a few examples. August 2016, Cliffs Natural Resources broke ground on the Project Mustang, $65 million cash investment in United Taconite to produce a Superflex pellet to serve our largest customer, ArcelorMittal USA. A Superflex pellet contains an additional limestone additive as compared to a standard pellet. This investment was made as a result of a long-term contract entered into between Cliffs and ArcelorMittal USA only a few months before, which preserved Cliffs' position as the company's sole outside supplier of pellets. Notably, this contract and investment resulted in bringing United Taconite back into production after nearly a one-year idle amidst a historic industry recession in 2015 and 16. With this investment, Cliffs is shifting production of the Superflex pellet from the Empire Mine in Michigan, where this pellet has historically been produced, to Minnesota's Iron Range. In doing so, Cliffs will cement United Taconite's position as one of our flagship operations. Furthermore, the $65 million investment has served as a critical lifeline to multiple Minnesota contractors and vendors who fell on hard times during the high-profile delinquencies and bankruptcies on the Iron Range in 2015 and 2016. At Hibbing Taconite, Cliffs and our partners made an investment in 2016 to add to the mine life to the operation by successfully negotiating a mutually beneficial agreement with St. Louis County to pay for a county road relocation that will result in an expansion of our mine pit, the continuation of 700-plus jobs, and the resultant economic impact, community, and state. And I'll turn it back to Patrick.
Thank you very much, Jack. I will now speak to the opportunities that we as Cliffs perceive to further grow and evolve our business while advancing the economy of Northeast Minnesota. In particular, I would like to speak to Cliffs' strategic goal to develop alternative iron units to serve the large and growing electric arc furnace segment of the domestic steelmaking market. In 1980, blast furnaces represented over 70% of the market for U.S. steel production. Since that time, this traditional method of steelmaking has continued to decline to the point that it's below 40% of the overall market share and has been since 2013. In contrast, electric arc furnaces, or EAFs, which rely predominantly on recycled scrap steel as a primary feedstock, have increased market share by continuing to move up the value chain of steel products. EAFs now represent approximately two-thirds of domestic steel production, two-thirds. For Minnesota, this is significant because nearly all of the taconite pellets produced on the Iron Range are designed specifically for consumption in integrated blast furnaces. In order for the EAF sector to continue its ascent and to enable production of high-quality flat-rolled steel products, these steelmakers must have access to virgin iron units free of the impurities associated with steel scrap. To be more specific, these facilities demand significant quantities of direct reduced iron, which is a high-quality metallic product consisting of at least 90% pure iron content. Cliffs is cognizant of these market dynamics and is already developing products to supply the DRI and EAF markets. Make no mistake, the future vitality and prosperity of Northeast Minnesota will depend on the ability of Iron Range companies such as Cliffs to tap into the large and growing EAF steelmaking market. Accordingly, we view the development of alternative iron products, such as DRI, as a critical objective that is shared by Cliffs as well as the state of Minnesota. Notably, Cliffs is prepared to meet these challenges because we have already demonstrated our ability to evolve in the past. As referenced in Jess Richards' testimony, when Cliffs first began operating, iron ore miners were able to extract high-grade reserves and ship them directly to steel mills with little to no processing. However, after two world wars, domestic iron ore miners found that the majority of these reserves had been depleted by the 1950s. During this defining moment for the domestic industry, Cliffs helped pioneer a beneficiation process through which iron ore pellets are produced from low-grade iron-bearing rock known as taconite. In fact, North Shore Mine, formerly Reserve Mining Company, was the first taconite processing facility in North America when it opened in 1955. It is fitting then that over the last 2 years, Cliffs has adjusted our production capabilities at North Shore to successfully execute full-scale tests of DR-grade pellets, which is a low-silica product specifically designed for production of DRI. We've used these pellets successfully in the DRI reactors of several EAF customers. In closing, Cliffs is proud of our 170-year history and the way in which our company has met and responded to the challenges that have been presented over the decades. Over the past 2.5 years, Cliffs has made significant progress in refocusing on our core U.S. iron ore operations while simultaneously weathering through perhaps the most severe commodity recession in recent memory. To illustrate this point, consider that a mere 12 months ago, Cliffs had upwards of 1,000 Minnesota employees on layoff. Despite those stiff headwinds, Cliffs' three Minnesota operations are back at full employment levels, and with a dramatically improved balance sheet, a stronger, leaner Cliffs is entirely focused on developing products for the steel industry of tomorrow. We firmly believe these investments will ensure our continued success and that of our employees and stakeholders well into the future. We are committed to our work with the legislature, and this committee in particular, to ensure that Minnesota is able to attract the investments necessary to ensure a bright future for the communities of the Iron Range. Thank you for your time this morning. We'd be more than happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Hey, thank you very much. Just kind of a question along kind of with that, the new technology to be able to use in the different types of furnace. You know, how far are you away from kind of that full implementation? So it still seems like that's in the experimental range, and where does that look?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Chairman Swidzinski. There is extreme urgency when it comes to Cliffs' development objectives surrounding DRI. There are several proven DRI technologies out there, and there are companies that are actively marketing those technologies. In fact, there have been two major DRI facilities constructed in the United States over the course of the last, I'd say, 5 years. A facility developed in Convent, Louisiana by Nucor, which I think was around a $750 million investment, and a facility in Texas operated by a European steel company known as Voestalpine, which I think was about a $740 million investment. However, we think there's significant pent-up demand for this product in the Midwest, in the Great Lakes region. So I think you'll see Cliffs move definitively and decisively in this direction over the course of the next several years, if not sooner, over the next several months even.
All right. Are those, I mean, just from a relational standpoint, are those technologies kind of a patent-driven portion, and so you're using outside vendors and buying access to those patents?
Yeah, we certainly partner with one of the companies that has that intellectual property, so to speak.
Okay, sounds good. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little follow-on on concept. Do you see any transportation issues? I notice you're talking Texas or Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ship much down to Mississippi right now. And I also understand there's likely a possibility of these smaller mills, electric furnace-based systems. It could show up in a lot of places that aren't necessarily down the lakes. Can you talk a little bit about you see in the future for transportation challenges, possibly?
Yeah, thank you for the,
Director Bloom?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question, Representative Lewick. With regard to some of the transportation logistics constraints, you're right in that it would be very difficult to transport DRI or even DR-grade pellets from Minnesota's Iron Range to the southern U.S., be it Louisiana or Texas. However, as I mentioned, we think there's significant pent-up demand for a DRI production facility in the Midwest to serve the existing mature EAF sector in this region of the country. And that is Cliff's goal, to develop such a DRI facility over the course of the coming months and years.
One comment on the transportation. Transportation is critical to our industry, whether it's pellets or DRI.
Representative Lewick?
I would say just one of the solutions would obviously be to locate those furnaces as close as possible to the source of the pellets, which would solve the transportation problem, or at least minimize it. So hopefully we'll be looking at that in the future also.
Director Bloom?
Duly noted, Representative Lewick. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for coming before us. You'll be around if there's some offline questions, I'm sure. We have City Councilor Liz Ligard on deck. And thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm a little nervous. I don't think I've ever been a closer before. I'm last on your agenda.
Well, there's not lunch waiting.
Oh. Update,
so. All right.
So, Mr. Chair, Committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity. My name is Dave Lissigard. I am a city councilor. for the city of Aurora. And let me begin by saying that we are very proud of our history that Mr. Richardson talked about earlier, in that mining to a ranger is like land to a farmer. And we are very, very proud of what we do. And the history and traditions of the Iron Range really do run as deep as the minerals under our feet. You know, Jack, Mr. Croswell mentioned since 1902, that's 115 years. That's a long time, and that's a very, very rich history. We as communities do understand the challenges facing our region, and they talk about wild rice. We are very, very concerned with that. My understanding is that the rulemaking there is separate from the cost analysis. And one is going to come out, the rulemaking is going to come out apparently in January of 18, while the cost analysis won't come out until May of 18. Communities, you can't base a decision on that. And frankly, we'll give you the keys to our city if you think that we can afford the cost to do that. And when the science is not even fully understood or even agreed upon, please don't allow them to make any rule without having all the information. We also understand that mining, the lifeblood of our region, is also having the same issues, and we stand with them. You know, the days of us versus them are no more. And that's why you heard Chris, and Chris's words were spoken with passion, I believe. And I believe that he really believes in the Iron Ore Alliance. Business and labor and communities coming together. We are facing a global crisis, and this is our way of life, and we do need to come together. And their challenges are our challenges. Their successes are our successes. And so we as communities across the Iron Range, Rams and others, are asking you to please consider when making decisions the broad effect that it has on our small communities. You know, it's well noted, I was here, there is an uptick, so we're feeling a little better, some positive news, but we're not out of the woodwork yet. In the last 3 years, it's been noted that in our community, we've lost our drugstore, we lost our grocery store, we continue to lose our dentist, and there's no more to take. So we need to build, and some positive things are going, but challenges are still in front of us. So we ask that you be very considerate of all aspects, and thank you for everything that you do. It's a tough job that you guys have, and we appreciate your support.
Well, thank you. Representative Metza, you have a question?
No, just a kind of a closing comment to today's testimony, unless there's going to be more public testimony. I can wait until after. So, you know, just a few things. Dave, first of all, thank you for coming down. It's always good to see you down here advocating for our communities, and very appreciated to have your support from our side. And you know, I think of things that we were able to do a few years back in my first term, one of which I'm very proud of was working with the legislature in a Buy American clause, which enabled 10 million pounds of American-made steel to be just on the Highway 53 bridge that we're moving right now and have discussed very thoroughly here over the last few years. And you know, just kind of give a little background on that. This was an agreement that the state went into back in the 60s that affects our entire region, and so I appreciate the support of my colleagues here in that and hope that we can have support moving forward along with President Trump, who I don't agree with him on much. But Buy American is something that I think he has made a huge priority and would have a huge benefit to these taconite companies and our steel producers across the country. And I don't want to talk a lot about the past because we've had a lot of conversations about the unemployment, so I'm just going to kind of keep moving forward. You know, I represent the most mining-centric district in the United States of America, which is a pretty cool thing. However, it comes with a lot of responsibility. And when Representative Uglum had mentioned earlier, and it looks like he had to leave, but he had mentioned how do we compete with China with stuff like this, and it's by supporting things like Buy American when we're using public tax dollars especially. I think that we could increase the share that we're going to be doing nationwide, especially with the infrastructure proposal that President Trump, which I also support, his infrastructure's proposal. We're very much lagging behind in the state of Minnesota in those investments, and I'll look forward to working with the majority on solutions for that this session. There's one thing guys like Dave and I and other community members can count on, and it's the almost precise clockwork of a mind blast. And everyone every day feels that little rumble, dishes shaken, and when it's not there is when it's kind of eerie. And so I'm glad we're to a point where I'm feeling it again, right on schedule from everyone. And Representative Lehman, and I'm kind of just skipping around here hitting some of the major points. I know we've got a busy and tight deadline schedule this year, but Laurentian Vision, you had brought that up, and I appreciate that. And Representative Sundin, a good example would be actually Lake Orbegon in Gilbert, who I've been working with for a few years, and actually just yesterday talked to the mayor of Gilbert with, and it's really cool. They've got actually a sunken helicopter out there. It's a reclaimed mine pit, gorgeous. It's actually Fortune Bay at one point almost located there. And I won't get into the regional disputes we've had. I think Tom Bach got him up to Cook, and it's great to have him on Lake Vermilion, though. but that would be a perfect site to have a new hotel in the region and a great opportunity for the agency to have a public-private partnership, because right now, part of the cliffs there, kids have jumped off them for years. We get traffic from all over the state, and the city recently closed down due to, you know, tight budgets and the liability insurance they would have had to acquire to actually keep that open to the public. So they've shut that down, kind of gated it off, and it's just an awesome resource. So I'm really hoping I can work with Representative Lehman and others to get projects like that with the Laurentian Vision grants that we have available. And so moving on from that question, we've got University of Minnesota, which none of us would be sitting in this room today had we not made the investments from previous legislatures in the taconite research. All of this stuff came out of us putting some money into making sure that we were a viable industry moving forward. And so the NRI has a new director, and I think they're on the right track to continue this research where it needs to be into developing what's the next taconite, a DRI grade type pellet. We've got a lot of those type things, and wouldn't it be great if the state of Minnesota were able to lease that technology to the companies here doing business, just like we did with some of the taconite production. So I guess in closing, thank you, Mr. Chair, for putting this presentation an opportunity for our communities to shine a little bit, and look forward to hearing what Dave's question is or comment.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, I just want to be the true closer. But anyway, Representative Mitza asked what Trump or those guys could do. How about we require that foreign countries meet the same standards that we meet? Because there ain't nobody that does it better than us. And we're very proud of what we do. So that would be something that they could do when they're talking about imports coming over here. So I'll leave with that one.
Sounds good. I think that since I'm the chair, I will actually close that. Representative Messi, you brought up some interesting points, and I think we discussed whether it be the sulfate standard, whether that be high energy costs. I mean, the headwinds are facing us pretty strong when it comes to this industry particularly, and we are probably the safest place in the world where this stuff is produced, but we also one of the largest in the United States when it comes to production of taconite and the rest. And we need to keep the industry moving forward and looking at that next technology. I think you mentioned the NRI. I believe they're asking for a little bit of an increase because of the dramatic changes they're having within their research institution and their people. I think that's someplace that we really need to look at how we can partner there to make sure that that's going to be making the next step and for the next generation of researchers that's going to be part of that group. And we look forward to working with you on that support and really look forward to the continuation of this important industry in our state of Minnesota and supporting it based on reality, not self-imposed killing the industry off. And I think that's what I think a lot of the folks in this room worry about, is that with the sulfate standard and what it could potentially do to our industry and how it can take us out of the market. And those are important things, and as we move forward, we look forward to work with the majority of minority members and people really from across the state, because whether you're involved in agriculture, guess what? You need steel to make crops. And whether you're involved in just general manufacturing, the steel industry plays a major part of what made this country great. And we just continue to do that work. So, awesome. Thank you very much, and thanks for coming. Any other questions or comments before we head out the door? Help yourself to a roll there, or aluminum-lined pop there. There it is. Thank you. We are adjourned.